Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab, and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen Rock, Black Rock, Little Rock, Oskaloosa, Tennessee, Tennessee, Chicopee, Spirit Lake, Grand Lake, Devil's Lake, Crater Lake.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. Sometimes you do exaggerate, but we appreciate that type of announcement that you do for us, and we thank you for getting us on the show one more time. This is show number 4,162. No, it's not that many. It just seems like that many. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'll have an announcement here later about Blog Talk Radio, some of the things that they're doing. I guess it's a product of getting big and getting well-known and making money, and they're doing very well. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that trip across the United States, 90 cities and states he passes through. And John, if you're sleeping outside tonight around that truck, get under the tires or something, you better get inside, because in the Midwest, at least, if you're stopping in Dayton, it is cold. I'm talking cold. People are cold. Mike, Emily, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Mike, thanks for trying to figure out the new Evernote, our new service. Evernote upgraded its our note-taking and our news clipping service, and it's a little, well, can I say it's not as good as the last version? And I think I've been through everything you can see, but that happens once in a while in the electronic media business. All right, the purpose of the show is to discuss news, issues, events, and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. You know, I had something interesting happen yesterday. I can't tell you the exact setting because it would tip someone off in terms of who actually said that. I heard a police officer talking to someone. He's saying he worked on patrol, and he worked patrol in the evening shift from somewhere, you know, 8 in the evening to 4 a.m. or something like that. And he was telling this person he was talking to, because they were talking about traffic tickets, he hadn't written a traffic ticket in 2 years. And as soon as he said that, I start looking for his CNI dog. He didn't have one, but I couldn't believe an officer could be out on the street for 2 years and not see a traffic ticket. I mean, I can drive out my driveway and probably see about four within, 3 minutes. But that is really something. Well, our show is dedicated to those tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. We've had some good cases of that here this past week. The gentleman who's, I guess, a retired police officer, and he was a security officer working, and the guy came in and shot at the school board members. Everybody's seen it on television by now, and he comes in and ends up shooting this guy and then disabling him, putting him down, and then the guy ends up shooting himself, I guess, in effect, committing suicide. But they do those kind of things, too. Then we had the Border Patrol agent killed this week, a real star police officer. If you look into the background of this guy, a former Marine also, and he was killed by these creeps that pick on all kinds of people on the border. It's a long story, but that's a very sad case. Well, you're listening on Blog Talk Radio. It's Leading Edge Technology. Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR and the genius behind the medium, as I'm fond of saying, and they're up to so many shows now that they're doing a little reorganization to make more sense out of it, and I'm sure it's a decision that helps them with money and acclaim and all kinds of things. But if you want to get a show, it says 20 different places, probably on the website, blogtalkradio.com. Any person in the interest group, any organization, you can have your own show. You can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it's absolutely free. Starting February 1, the free is only going to be, you can do a show every day, it can be 30 minutes. But if you're in the free business, you don't upgrade to what they call premium, then your shows can't be done in prime time. And Blog Talk Radio considers prime time from 7 in the evening until 11 p.m. So anybody that's doing a show that's or they're signed up free, the service that I've been using for 4 years or more, then you're going to have to pay them some money or move your show time and cut it down to a half hour. So I guess that's the announcement I was going to talk about. We're going to be thinking about that. We've got to February 1 to do some considerations relative to that. These shows are archived almost immediately, and you can pick those things up and download them yourself, keep them, take them with you, whatever you want to do, and that's absolutely free also. Tonight we're going to do something a little bit different, and I thought this is interesting. We like old-time radio. And I found this particular series of shows, I think there's about 10 of them, and it's called Case Dismissed. And this was a little experiment by WMAQ Radio in Chicago, and it's an NBC station, back in 1954. And what they did is they came up with a series of, I think it's 10 shows, if I'm not mistaken, 10 radio shows, maybe it's 12. But anyway, they're a half hour each. And what they did is try to teach some type of legal principle, like how to buy property and that type of thing, but they did it through fiction. In other words, they were actually stories, and they had characters. Sometimes the acting was good, sometimes it wasn't so good. But the one we're going to play tonight has to do with juvenile delinquency. That's what it's called. And that's a double message for the state of Illinois, because Illinois is the state that started the juvenile court back in 1899. Prior to that time, juveniles went into adult court. Of course, you know, most of the time they got mercy. And somebody came up with the idea after fighting for it for about 10 or 15 years, let's create a whole separate system for juveniles who commit crime and delinquency. And they started the juvenile court in 1899. So what this is about is trying to control your kids and keep them from becoming juvenile delinquents. That fits right in with the period of that time of day, or the time of criminal justice in the 1950s, where we were absolutely sold on rehabilitation and treatment, and we thought that everybody was subject to, with the right counseling, the right whatever, we could turn them around. We've since found out that that's not that easy. But anyway, that's going to be show tonight, and it's going to be a replay of a WMAQ Chicago station. And the show is called Juvenile Delinquency. You're listening on your Windows Media Player. You're listening on your computer. So you can listen on your cell phone, whatever you want to do. If you want to call the show during the news segment tonight, you could call 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983. We can hold about 5 calls at a time. We haven't done that in a very long time, but we have it one time or another. Well, Audrey's got a joke for us tonight. And she's been specializing here in the last several weeks on some of her favorites as the year 2010 closes down. And I really like this one. Audrey, go ahead and play your joke for tonight. I should emphasize that Audrey is a blonde. She collects blonde jokes, and she's not offended whatsoever by blonde jokes. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, The blonde joke for tonight is both funny and tragic. I think our listeners will enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde and a redhead went to the bar after work for a drink and sat on stools watching the 6 o'clock news. A man was shown threatening to jump from the Brooklyn Bridge, and the blonde bet the redhead $50 that he wouldn't jump. Sure enough, he jumped. So the blonde gave the redhead $50. The redhead said, "I can't take this. You're my friend." But the blonde insisted, saying, "No. A bet's a bet." Then the redhead said, "Listen, I have to tell you that I saw this on the 5 o'clock news, so I can't take your money." The blonde replied, "Well, so did I, but I didn't think he would jump again."
And I guess he probably jumped at 7 o'clock and 8 o'clock and maybe more that evening also. That's a good one, Audrey. Thank you very much. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has a public service announcement that they would like the criminals in the state of Ohio and all over the country to hear so that they can hear this message, feel the commitment, feel the guilt, and take their firearms and get out and turn them into the police department. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. It certainly is a deadly idea. Well, let's get here just a moment. Let's look at some of these news stories. But first, I'm going to do our green tip. And we're going to depart from our usual procedure tonight where I normally... I have been using Esma Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. And there's one here that's in the news that I think is going to be just tremendous in terms of saving our planet. And I think you've probably seen them if I can creep through the new version of Evernote. It's got to be on here somewhere. Things used to be easier to find. Here it is. And here's what it is. It's to eat less, imagine eating more. I'm not kidding you. In other words, you'd be saving the planet by eating less, preserving food, not causing as much. Well, I won't go into that. But before dipping your hand into that bowl of M&Ms, it says at the holiday party, think about what you're about to do. A lot, a new study finds that people who imagine themselves consuming many pieces of candy will eat less of the real thing when they're given the chance. The findings, say experts, would lead to the development of better weight loss strategies. And, of course, we're obsessed with weight loss strategies here in the United States. Picturing a delicious food like a juicy steak or an ice cream sundae generally whets the appetite. But what about visualizing yourself eating the entire sundae, spoonful by spoonful? You folks listening tonight, do that. Get yourself a good hot fudge sundae and then just look at it and don't eat it, but just imagine yourself eating it spoonful by spoonful. Don't tell anybody about it because they'll come a lot. No, excuse. There's reason to think that they might have the opposite effects, as Kerry Moorledge, an experimental psychologist, that's kind of Carnegie Mellon at Pittsburgh. Researchers have found that repeated exposure to a particular food, as in taking bite after bite of it, decreases the desire to consume more. This process, which psychologists call habituation, dampens the appetite. I do they have a good name for it. Dampens the appetite independently of physiological signals like rising blood sugar levels or an expanding stomach. But no one had looked to see whether merely imagining eating has the same effect. So to investigate, Moorledge and his colleagues, Hu and Joachim Vosguru fed M&Ms and cheese cubes to 51 undergraduate students. In one experience, the participants first imagined performing 33 repetitive motions. Half of them imagined eating 30 M&Ms and inserting them, inserting 3/4 into the slot of a laundry machine. The other half envisioned eating 3 M&Ms and inserting 3/4. Then everyone's allowed to eat their fill from a bowl of M&Ms. Those who envisioned eating more candy ate about 3 M&Ms on the average
whereas the others ate about 5 M&Ms. So all that imagining, you're saving yourself 2 M&Ms. Aren't M&Ms like those little tiny, those little tiny things, right? So you're all that work there and imagining you're saving yourself 2 M&Ms. Of course, they did do questionnaires. How do we ever know they're telling the truth on the questionnaire? And the subject reported the mental imagery doesn't diminish how much they like a particular food. But a final experiment in which they played a computer game to earn cheese cubes suggested that mental imagery can reduce the effort people will expend to get food. I think we could probably top that with, what, locks on the refrigerators, timed locks or something like that. Who knows? But the search continues for the way to lose weight, and I just don't know how skinny we're trying to get, but we'll see. This has come up since I talked with you last week. You remember the gentleman that was accused of plotting to kill military recruiters with a car bomb? He claims he's the victim of entrapment, and he was incapable of building or detonating explosives, his lawyer said Monday, this past Monday in court. Antonio Martinez, he prefers to be called what would he rather be called? Mohammed Hussein. He converted Islam. He said that the FBI gave him this fake bomb that he went to detonate. Of course, it wouldn't detonate, which is good. and that really he was entrapped. In other words, they caused him to commit a crime that he didn't do. Well, the judge finally says in federal district court, he ordered Mr. Martinez detained pending trial. Said he can't get bail. He was dangerous on a flight risk. And the defense's entrapment argument, he said, really is an issue for another day in court, which it is. But they're saying, this is, we had the same thing out in Portland, Oregon, I think, where the FBI gave him a bomb that wouldn't work. And he went down at the supposedly the Christmas tree lighting ceremony and was going to set off a bomb there. So the encouragement to commit a crime is totally permissible. That's providing somebody a real good opportunity to commit the crime. You're allowed to do that as an undercover cop. But entrapment, where you're causing somebody to commit a crime they ordinarily wouldn't do, that would be entrapment. A little rule of thumb about it is in whose mind did the crime originate, but that doesn't tell you everything. So if the FBI gave him the idea, that would be one point toward the idea that it was in fact entrapment, which is illegal. And he would be acquitted of the offense. Or not even charged, for that matter. Has everybody heard about the iPhone switch? Mike, have you heard about that one? The snitch application. Now on your iPhone, you can download an application that's got a whole bunch of buttons on it. And what you're supposed to do there, these buttons integrate with federal agencies, the FBI, the EPA, the GEO, the CDC, the custom integration with user employees, and social media, Facebook, all this stuff, the FBI's most wanted, and these little graphical buttons, and you can report according to category, government waste, there's a button for that, I've seen it, environmental crime or possible violations, white-collar crime, workplace harassment, discrimination, or other violations, and public health concerns. So this is truly a snitch application for the iPhone. Now, would you believe that the guys that made the thing up are connected with Homeland Security? So the idea is you can call Homeland Security, maybe you can call Janet herself, Napolitano, and you can call her up and report suspicious activity. Remember, she's at Walmart now. We mentioned that last week. So if you see somebody with something unusual, then you can call all these things. If you don't like your boss, I guess you could call, according to this snitch thing. So, it's kind of interesting. I wonder if the people that don't like this idea, who downloaded the app to see what it's like, wonder if the people who gave them the download could also turn on their phone and kind of do a little monitoring of them. Who knows? Anyway, it's kind of interesting to see. I think we're sort of obsessed with that. This was kind of interesting and related to what I'm just talking about. The court just ruled, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, that for agency, the police, federal police, mainly here we're talking about, for the federal police to get your emails, they have to have a warrant. Can you imagine that? Because they've been doing it all over the place without a warrant. So now to get your emails, they must go to a judge and establish probable cause and particularly describe the place to be searched and the third persons to be seized right out of the Fourth Amendment. Doesn't it sound like a lot like America? Imagine that. Did you have to get a warrant to steal somebody's or to look into somebody's private mail? I think that's a step back into the right direction, if I must say so. But this idea of being able to look into anybody's email anytime, and I know what everybody's going to say. If you're not doing anything wrong, what makes any difference? It makes a difference because it's not the government's business unless you're involved in some type of criminal activity. So unless they can establish that at a low level with probable cause, doesn't even tip the scales, it's not even halfway up, then, in fact, you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be snooping on people in that regard. I thought this one was just so federal. let me find this one. We had a group study. Hold on just a second. Yes, the U.S. Department of Education and its investigators have studied Virginia Tech. The Virginia Tech shooting was in 2007. But the U.S. Department of Education, let's see, this is 2010, right? It's almost over. It's almost 2011. U.S. Department of Education has issued a final ruling on Thursday that says Virginia Tech violated campus crime reporting law in its response to the shootings on April 16th, 2007. On that day, a student fatally shot two others in a residence hall at 7:15, and the issue issued a warning. Shortly after that, the guy goes to fire shots in an academic building, killing 30 more students and a professor. That's a great story, that Romanian professor. I think he came here in 1988, and he ran up to the door and blocked the door and took the bullets himself and saved the lives of other students. But they're saying that it took Virginia Tech too long to come up with a warning for the rest of the people on campus. Let me see. The federal agency took from 2007 to 2010. I'm sure they didn't take too long, because they had to investigate this. But anyway, it's terrible. That was one of the most tragic events that's ever occurred on campus, I believe, in criminal justice history. But I just thought that sounded a little odd, that they took too long to get the federal government. It took 3 years to make that particular decision. Now, this one, this would require a lot of discussion, and criminologists would go over this backwards and forwards, but Switzerland, wonderful place, people vacation there. I've never been there myself. I guess I've flown over it a few times. The upper house of the Swiss parliament has drafted a law that will decriminalize, they've tried this before, but it will decriminalize sex between consenting family members. In other words, they're going to drop their incest laws, which now must be considered by the government. There have been only 3 cases of incest since 1984. Can you believe that? Yeah. 3 cases of incest since 1984 in Switzerland. They're saying that, you know, their idea is, what's wrong if they're consenting family members? You know, you can, you know, figure out those pairings up as you wish, but, you know, why would we want to stop people in a family from having sex with each other? My, how far have we gone? Anyway, the Christian People's Party of Switzerland said the proposal from the upper house was completely repugnant. I think I would join the Christian People's Party of Switzerland and say the same thing. And they sound like this is going to pass. It's probably going to happen. But isn't that absolutely incredible? It's really, really something. What else have I got here for you? Homeland Security, of course, is worried about what's going to come up here. They've got a little tip out of Iraq, that says that Al-Qaeda and the others are planning some holiday type of bombs. Of course, they've won already as soon as they say that, because we go into double down type of security and overtime and all kinds of other things to try to prevent that. I understand that, but are the terrorists winning when all they have to do is say a few things and we spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of more dollars over a couple weeks in order to protect everybody? I think the answer to that, which is requires a long explanation, but isn't it offense instead of defense? I'm still amazed that we can't find these people. we can't find Osama bin Laden. I mean, that, to me, that astounds me. But anyway, that's another topic for another day. Well, what we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at this show called Juvenile Delinquency. And this show aired in 1954. They were all half-hour segments. They were part of this Case Dismiss. And it was the legal profession and the media getting together to try to do some public education on legal issues, and they were trying to do it through fictional accounts, in other words, through stories, through a crime type of drama, or whatever the subject was for that. So here we go. We're going to start out with Case Dismissed. It takes a little while to get the sound right. It starts off a little hard to hear, but it clears up eventually. So here we go. Case Dismissed from
1954.
Hey, dismissed.
We weren't
going to
steal his old car. We were just going for a joyride.
I'll joyride you, you numbskull. Now get inside.
Oh.
Buried in the sea, starts down the trail of delinquency. One of the home factors. And what can the law do for him before it's too late? What can happen to have his case dismissed? WMAQ, in cooperation with the Chicago Bar Association, presents Case Dismissed. This is the story of legal rights, how vital to preserve and protect them, how easily they may be lost. Today's story begins in the law offices of Robert Dayton. A young newspaper reporter sits opposite him.
Well, Mr. Dayton, as I explained on the phone, my paper is starting a series on juvenile delinquency. From a constructive angle, of course.
Well, thank goodness for that, Mr. DeWitt. It's had more than its share of destructive publicity, especially when it comes to exaggeration. But why have you come to me?
Well, sir, you're widely known for your good work in movements designed to cure juvenile delinquency.
I'm glad you used the word cure, Mr. DeWitt. Delinquency is really a disease of a sick society, reflecting the insecurity of the time. That's why parents with stable emotions and a mature family life seldom have problem children.
Well, Mr. Dayton, I'd like you to give me the lawyer's viewpoint on juvenile delinquency.
Well, sir, although the family lawyer can be as helpful as the family doctor, if he's summoned in time, once a delinquent act has taken place, the lawyer's role becomes of minor importance.
You mean there's not much he can do for a youngster?
No. Actually, I mean that the law is much more important than the lawyer because, well, Illinois was a pioneer in thoughtful legislation for juveniles.
Thoughtful?
Yes. Prior to 1899, if a child over 10 years of age got into trouble, he could be jailed and then taken before the criminal court, where a permanent public record was made. Then the Illinois legislature pioneered in making a new application of an old doctrine of English law under which children could be treated as wards of the state and protected by the Lord Chancellor. That was the basis for the Illinois law creating the juvenile court, now called the family court.
In other words, the state had a responsibility to its youngsters until they reached adult age.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
They became wards of the court if they were juveniles, meaning under 17 if a boy or under 18 if a girl.
Just what did this Illinois law do, Mr. Dayton?
Well, basically, it changed the entire attitude toward young people who get into trouble. It doesn't aim at punishment. It offers treatment of an ill, which is what delinquency is, after all.
I see.
Now, there's a big difference between an official and an unofficial delinquent. The official delinquent is one who gets caught. The unofficial delinquent is a member of a gang, what we call a natural playgroup, which indulges in delinquent acts, anything from skipping school to vandalizing homes and classrooms, and from running away from home to sexual misconduct or stealing cars. It's both an individual problem and a group problem.
Yes, I can see that now.
I'd like you to see it even more plainly. I'd like to tell you about Billy.
Billy?
Yes, we'll call him Billy Stone. His father works for an engineering concern, fancies himself quite an intellectual. Billy's mother is an affectionate woman, friendly and sincere, and an accomplished musician. The first time we meet Billy, he's 12 years old.
Yes, Carl?
Would it be asking too much for you to cease that infernal racket?
But, Carl, I get so little time at my piano. The evenings...
And that's the way we'll keep it, Lydia. The only reason I bought this home with the extra bedroom was so that I'd have a place to go in the evenings to read my books. And what comes crashing through the walls? Your piano music.
But, Carl, I only play the piano for diversion. If you'd just come out of that room of yours once in a while, be a part of your family.
I don't want to be a part of my family. Heaven knows I have better use for my idle time than to spend it with a wife whose only topic of conversation is the latest trashy romantic novel and a son who's both a weakling and a dull student. But it's true. I set up a punching bag outfit for Bill in the basement. He takes a couple of swipes at it and forgets the whole thing. Then I try to interest him in a chemistry set. After one experiment, it's too much trouble for him. The same thing happened to the mineral collection. I take time out to help him as a father should, and he doesn't even appreciate it.
But you're so short with him, Carl. One mistake and you're telling him how wrong he is, how dull.
Well, he is. Bill is a total loss when it comes to learning.
Carl, he can hear
you. What difference? The boy will never amount to anything. He isn't interested in anything worthwhile.
But he wants to learn to play the piano.
I said worthwhile. And don't let me catch you teaching him that sissy's hobby. Do you understand, Lydia?
I understand, Carl.
And another thing. You can just tell your stupid gang of friends they needn't come over here tomorrow night. I won't waste my valuable time talking their inane small talk. I don't choose to be bored. Tell them to stay home.
But, Carl, that's not fair. They're nice people, and if you'd just come out of that cave of yours and stop being a hermit, you'd enjoy them.
Hermit, eh? Well, that's the only worthwhile existence I can find in this dull family. Are you going to tell those morons to stay home?
Carl, I can't just...
Lydia, I'm warning you. Tell them to...
Carl, please. Please, don't just... You're hurting my arm. Carl, please.
Papa, you're hurting my mother. Stop it.
Oh, so Mama's boy gets fresh with his father, eh?
Here.
How could you all come here, Billy, dear?
That little fool. He won't cry. Why doesn't he cry?
No, Billy didn't cry, no matter how much he wanted to. But he did in the privacy of his room. And the following afternoon, he failed to return from school. His father raged and his mother waited in stony fear for Billy to come home. Then, finally, that night.
Well?
The boy you're looking for?
Yes?
We have him here at the police station. Nabbed him just as he was boarding the bus.
Oh.
Said he wanted to leave home for good.
Oh, he did, eh? Well, you hold him there, officer. I'll be down shortly. I'll teach that brat to run away from me.
Billy's father taught the boy in no uncertain terms. His mother stood by, brokenhearted, unable to stop him. Shortly after this, she began having violent headaches and returning to her room for long periods of time, a semi-invalid. And Billy? Well, young Bill's confidence gradually disappeared. He lost all faith in himself as his father continued to heap scorn on him, regarding him as a slow-witted youngster with no future whatever.
You know, it's hard to believe there are fathers like that.
Yes, it is, Mr. DeWitt. Bill's record begins to show reports of truancy now. Well, not serious in themselves, but danger signals of an unstable young fellow.
Mm-hmm.
A year later, when Billy was 13, the Stone family moved to a new home, this time in an industrial suburb of Chicago. There, the emotionally upset boy fell in with a gang of young delinquents. Well, the influence of his new companions began to show up at home now. Vulgar language and more defiant attitude, a secretive, evasive manner. He began using every trick he knew to stay out later and later with his gang. His mother became more upset, and his father more viciously domineering than ever before. Trouble was in the air, and it wasn't long in happening.
Yes? Oh, it's you, Mr. Gardner.
Is this your boy, Stone?
Billy? Yes, what's he been up to?
Freddy, I caught him with another kid driving off with my car. The other kid got away. They were stealing the car.
What?
We weren't going to steal his old car. We were just going for a joyride.
I'll joyride you, you numbskull. Now you get inside.
Ow! Got it out!
Inside or I'll take care of you later.
As you might have expected, Carl Stone beat his son Billy unmercifully. He tried to beat the name of Billy's partner out of him, but already he'd learned the code of the underworld. The respect of the gang meant everything to him.
Mm-hmm.
His quivering lips remained sealed. The neighbor threatened to inform the police of Billy's act, and Carl, the father, did little to prevent it. But Billy's mother rallied to his cause and went to see the only person of influence she knew, a precinct captain. He advised her strongly against letting the boy associate with tough characters, said he had talked to Mr. Gardner, that the boy might have a police record if the police heard of it. And Billy got off this time. His few remaining privileges taken away by his father, Billy's existence at home became more and more bitter. To make matters worse, the domestic discord between father and mother increased. Billy turned more and more to his gang, and he began using every ruse in the book to get out of his house and join them in the evening. Sometimes he succeeded, but often his father discovered the secret and thrashed him for it. Kept close to home, Billy found little to occupy his idle hours. To encourage his interest in music, Lydia Stone bought a phonograph for her 13-year-old son and warned him to play it in his room only when his father wasn't home. Billy did his best, but one day he slipped.
Dad, you're home early.
That disgusting music. Here, give me that.
What are you going to do with my record? Dad, don't smash it. Don't.
Where did you get this infernal machine?
It was given to me by... Somebody gave it to me.
Give it to me.
No.
I said give it to me.
Oh, all right.
I'll put this where you'll never use it again. A fine thing, a child as slow-witted as you, wasting time listening to a phonograph when you should be studying, trying to catch up with your class.
Don't worry, I'll get by.
What's that?
I said don't worry, I'll get by.
I'll attend to you later, young man. You stay in your room.
After this incident, Billy turned even more completely to the gang. Not only did they accept him as one of their own, they had a makeshift clubhouse where a boy could forget his own unhappy home, and in it was a phonograph. Mm-hmm. Every kid in the gang loved the latest hot records, and they'd play them over and over as soon as somebody would steal them from a record shop. And that, by the way, leads to young Billy's downfall.
Well, he was caught stealing phonograph records?
Well, yes and no, Mr. DeWitt. One evening, Billy succeeded in outwitting his parents with the excuse of having to go to the public library nearby for schoolwork. Instead, he met three other members of his gang, two boys and a girl. The objective of the night was burglary. The store was the Peerless Music Center, not far from the home neighborhood and well cased by the young delinquent. From the alley, they made their way to a side window. Like hardened criminals, they jimmied the window quickly and made their way inside the store. The cheap strong box was easy enough to find and easy to carry, but opening it was quite another matter. While the two older boys struggled with the cash box, Billy and the girl inspected the music store. Billy spied a stack of new LP recordings, slipped a few choice items underneath his jacket. Something to please the gang, he thought. Something to make them proud of me. Finally, a splash of yellow light from the front window fell on the four of them. The night policeman making his round. They scrambled to their feet. The oldest boy tucked the metal box under his arm and gave the order to run and separate. They ran.
Stop! Stop or I'll shoot!
Billy Stone ran all the way home, then paused outside to catch his breath before entering, fearful of causing suspicion. Then he went in and headed straight for his room and his bed. His mother, ill as she was so frequently, lay asleep in her room. Billy's father, by himself with his books as always, heard the boy enter and was content with that. And Billy was frightened. He lay there in the dark, half expecting to see a policeman enter his bedroom, tense for the ring of the doorbell. But it didn't happen until the following morning, a Saturday.
Are you Mr. Carl Stone?
Yes, officer.
You have a son, Billy Stone?
That's right. What's he done, officer?
I wonder if I could see him, sir.
I'll get him, officer. What's he done?
Well, there's been a burglary in the neighborhood, sir. We only know he's been seen with a bad bunch of kids. I'd like to question him, please.
Certainly. I'll go get him right away, officer.
The police officer questioned Billy at length about his friends and his activities of the night before, but he learned little. It was incredible that a 13-year-old child could be so steeped in the code of the criminal. But the officer wasn't taken in. He knew his juvenile delinquents, and so he took steps to double-check Billy's story.
Billy, I found these phonograph records in your room. Where did you get them, son?
Well, tell the officer, or I'll...
Take it easy, sir. Billy, where did you get these records?
A friend gave them to me.
I see. When did this friend give them to you?
Well, I think it was about a month ago.
Who was this friend, son?
Well, I don't know. It was Charlie. Charlie Smith.
You're lying. You don't know any Charlie Smith.
How do you know? You don't know any of my friends, Dad. You don't know anything about me.
I'm sorry, Billy, but these records aren't a month old. They have the Peerless Music Center stamp on the back of the album. You see, they were taken from the Peerless Music Center last night, weren't they, son?
Well, speak up, answer the officer.
Billy, you're going to have to come with me.
I suppose you're taking him to the police station.
No, sir. I'll take him to the juvenile detention home intake.
The juvenile detention home intake is part of the juvenile court building, and there the treatment for Billy's affliction began. Not punishment, mind you, but treatment. These are friendly, well-trained social workers who toil only for Billy's betterment in a quiet, confidential way at all times. Knowing the information won't be used against him, Billy makes a clean breast of the burglary, as well as his earlier escapades.
Well, then the precinct captain was wrong when he warned Billy's mother about the authorities giving Billy a police record. Is that right, Mr. Dayton?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, Mrs. Stone made another mistake trying to enlist the precinct captain's aid again in Billy's case. The family court doesn't respect that kind of interference.
I certainly can see why.
Well, the following day, Billy was scheduled to appear before the complaint department of the juvenile court. His parents were notified and were asked to appear with him before the staff of social workers making the initial determination of the case. That was when they asked me to represent them. As you might have expected, the father preached and the mother sympathized, and never once did the two get on common ground. As the staff of social workers listened, they got the complete picture of Billy's life, and they prepared to make their initial determination of the case.
Oh, the social workers make the original decision?
Yes, Mr. DeWitt. They have four alternatives. One is filing a petition alleging incorrigibility and setting a court date, in which case the youngster is returned to the detention home.
I see.
A second possibility is that a complaint can be taken, that is, a record made of the offense and turned over to a probation officer who later checks with the family on the child's behavior.
Yes. Yeah.
In this case, the child goes home with his parents.
Mm-hmm.
A third method is the making of a letter file in the complaint department. It's not referred to a probation officer, and the youngster, of course, is released immediately.
Yes.
The fourth possibility is rare, and that's where the case is dismissed and no further action taken.
Well, what happened in the Billy Stone case?
Well, Billy's past record was largely in his favor, but the seriousness of breaking and entering and burglary was sufficient to warrant a court appearance.
Yes.
A date was set, and Billy was returned to the detention home, but only overnight. The next day, the court referee considered his case and released Billy to his parents.
And then I suppose nothing happened until the day of the court appearance.
On the contrary, quite a great deal happened. A probation officer visited the Stone family and Billy and put together a thorough social history on each of them. She learned about their backgrounds, their personalities and attitudes, their family relationships, everything that had any bearing on Billy's habits, emotions, and tension.
Yes.
It was obvious that the unrelenting and domineering attitude of Carl Stone was the one major factor in Billy's feeling of insecurity and inferiority.
Mm-hmm.
All this he could forget when he was with the gang, where he was an equal, as long as he kept their rules. Before the probation officer concluded her interviews with the Stones, each of them made rather revealing statements about their plans for the future.
I feel that I've let my own emotions run away with me at Billy's expense. I think if I spend less time in bed worrying about my own troubles and ailments and more time counseling Billy and offering him constructive guidance, well, I'm sure he'll have no more problems he can't bring home.
Well, I can't stand by and see Billy bring more shame on the good name of Stone. Maybe I can do something. I'll try to extend myself a little and attempt to understand the boy. I give you my word on that.
I know I've done wrong, sir. And honest, it isn't fun stealing and things like that. The fun is just belonging to the gang. I think most of the kids feel the same way. After a while, you get the idea that you can't stop it. I think if they all had a chance to start over, they'd be pretty good kids.
And what about you, Billy?
You can count on me, ma'am. I've learned my lesson, and I'm going to mind my parents and behave from now on. I won't be getting into trouble again, ma'am.
The probation officer took a favorable view of the future as she prepared her report for the family court judge. Billy's father remained a psychological stumbling block, but the renewed determination of his mother, coupled with Billy's healthier attitude, promised real hope.
Well, when did the court hearing take place, Mr. Dayton?
About 4 weeks after the original appearance in the complaint department.
I see.
Before that, however, the state's attorney's office has the right to demand that a case involving a crime, as Billy's did, be turned over to the grand jury for action.
You mean he could be prosecuted as a criminal?
Yes, the courts have held that our law on juvenile delinquency does not prohibit criminal prosecution. But there are quite a few ifs in that, Mr. DeWitt. First of all, if the child is under 10 years of age, He's presumed to lack criminal capacity and can only be proceeded against as a delinquent.
I see.
If he's between 10 and 14, criminal prosecution is possible only at the state's attorney's discretion.
Mm-hmm.
And if the state's attorney can prove the child knows the difference between right and wrong.
And Billy wasn't quite 14.
That's right. And the state's attorney's office decided against criminal prosecution. So the family court proceeding took place as scheduled, again with no reporters or spectators present.
Mm-hmm.
I was there again purely as legal counsel for the Stones to help explain any technicalities that might not be completely clear to them. The police officer who had apprehended Billy read the charge to the judge of the family court.
Billy, are the facts exactly as the officer read them?
Yes, sir. That's all true.
All right. Then I think we'll ask you a few questions, Billy, and then a few questions of your parents.
Patiently and thoughtfully, the judge questioned the boy, learned his opinions and attitude, then turned to his parents for further comment. Previously, he had studied Billy's complete file, including the case histories prepared by the social workers. The court asked for the recommendations of the probation officer. The probation officer felt that domestic discord and failure to respect and attend to the boy's emotional needs had been important factors leading toward his delinquency. She had obtained promises of a much improved home life from Billy's mother, important concessions from his father, and Billy's own word that he would leave his gang activities and seriously work at a healthy, worthwhile life. His recommendation was against commitment to a treatment agency at this time. He believed Billy belonged in his own home if it was improved as promised. The judge heard several others connected with the case and finally presented his own recommendation. He recognized Billy's good reputation up until recent developments, but he sternly warned him where his present path might lead if he continued to follow it. He emphasized the need of respect for the property of others, and you could see that Billy understood.
Well, what about Billy's father in this picture?
The judge had a message for Billy's parents, of course, and an especially harsh one for Carl Stone.
Carl Stone, it is neither the duty nor the wish of the family court involve itself with the normal relationship of families or of one member of a family with another. But when such actions lead to antisocial developments, we must interfere and, if necessary, take action. Now, there's little doubt in my mind that your unfeeling attitude of smugness and actual hostility toward your son, your unwillingness to build and preserve a happy home life, have been prime causes for his downfall. There's nothing in his past record or in his educational tests that show the subnormal intelligence you claim. I'm going to send Billy home with you and Mrs. Stone. In 6 months, I want you to appear here in court again. Meanwhile, the probation officer will call on you once a month. If this boy of yours doesn't find the security and recognition necessary to keep a growing young fellow off the streets and away from destructive gangs, then not only will Billy answer to me, but you, Carl Stone, will answer to me in full. Is that clear to you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Cases of this type are rarely dismissed completely, Mr. DeWitt. However, there were two other alternatives for the judge. He could have committed Billy to the newly organized Illinois Youth Commission for further study of his case and possible commitment to the Illinois Training School at St. Charles. Or he might have referred Billy to a special school or farm for a period of time with Billy's parents paying the cost.
Well, did his decision to send Billy home work out?
Yes, it did, Mr. DeWitt. Billy straightened out wonderfully, and most of the thanks goes to Mrs. Stone, who had developed his home life and training. Carl Stone's only contribution has been to halt his domineering attitude toward the boy and his mother. His company has put him on the road, and I suppose you might say his absence from the scene has been helpful in a negative sort of way.
Well, the important thing is that Billy Stone is back on the right path.
Exactly, Mr. DeWitt. And Illinois' intelligent approach to the treatment of their young wards can be thanked to a large extent. While it's true there is quite a maze of laws, courts, and institutions, the new Illinois Youth Commission has greatly improved the situation. It's good to know that in our state, the constant aim today is true justice for our juveniles.
Now, here to comment on today's story is your counselor, Dean John C. Fitzgerald of the Loyola University Law School. Dean Fitzgerald.
In addition to the immediate threat of delinquency to society, there is still another danger which most youngsters do not realize. That is his future. Many times a chance to succeed in a trade, business, or profession can explode overnight when your childhood record comes back to haunt you. That is the reason why family court proceedings in delinquency cases are not recorded. That is also the reason why it is important to hire a lawyer if your child is involved in legal trouble. He can offer good counsel that may well prevent future occupational tragedy. If you do not know a lawyer, get in touch with the Chicago Bar Association. The association offers, as a public service, a lawyer reference service which will refer you to an attorney. In addition to this, the Chicago Bar Association has a special committee on juvenile delinquency and adolescent offenders, whose purpose is to keep an ever-watchful eye on legislation and administration of justice pertaining to juveniles. May I point out, as always, that the legal points in today's story were based on Illinois law and may not apply in your state. I must remind you, too, that the facts in your situation will probably differ from the facts presented in our story. This difference in the facts may change the application of the law. With this afternoon's story, our Case Dismissed series comes to a close. We hope that these programs on your legal rights and how to protect them have been helpful and enjoyable to you. Until next we meet, this is your counselor, Dean John C. Fitzgerald, wishing for each of you a good night, good luck, and good laws.
Case dismissed. Case Dismissed has been written by Robert Carman and is based on information supplied by the Chicago Bar Association and its lawyer members. All characters were fictitious, and any resemblance to any person living or dead is purely coincidental. Members of the cast were Gretchen Thomas, Stanley Gordon, Jack Lester, Harry Elders, Carlton Cadell, and Jerry Garvey. Case Dismissed is produced by Betty Ross. Direction is by Herbert Latow. Musical effects were transcribed. Sound by Tom Evans. Engineering by Dan Hozek. This is Lee Bennett speaking on behalf of the Chicago Bar Association and station WMAQ, thanking you for listening to our broadcast and for your letters and comments about the series. We hope you'll join us again next fall when we hope to bring you more stories about your legal rights on Case Dismissed.
The music is interesting, isn't it? Interesting little episode, and of course, the doctrine that they operate the juvenile court under goes way back into England, and it's called parens patriae, the father of the country, father of the land, where the state becomes a surrogate parent for the child, and tries to see that the child's raised properly. But anyway, you can go to archive.org and type in Case Dismissed in the little search panel, and you can get the other shows there. But an interesting experiment. Looks like it didn't go over very well, but the Bar Association and the media getting together and through fiction, doing accounts to teach people about the law. Well, that's going to be it for our show tonight. Join us next week, see what we're going to do, and have a good evening.
Again, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue sky drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long.